Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome inside China Basin, your San Francisco Giants three times a week podcast on thesportsvirus.com, featuring Giants players like all-star catcher Buster Posey.
It's about, you know, just going out and trying to have passion for the game that I've loved since I was a kid.
Giants third baseman Matt Duffy joins us each homestand.
I think when I'm going best is when I'm just staying short, trying to hit the ball right back up the middle and seeing it well.
And San Francisco Chronicle columnist John Shea is our regular guest, too.
Bumgarner, he's a god, isn't he? He does all these things that no other humans do.
Inside China Basin is brought to you by Tamron Lenses and Keeble & Shuckett Photography in Palo Alto. They have the perfect lens for you. Today we have part two of our conversation with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle as part of our on-site podcast at Keeble & Shuckett Photography in Palo Alto. We're going to talk a little bit about a former Giant, Tim Lincecum, and he has signed with the Angels, and you wrote a story, John, about him succeeding. You think he's going to succeed is what I took from that story, that because you outlined 10 reasons why Tim Lincecum will succeed with the Angels. So go over the reasons here a little bit, and, you know, is there a disappointment factor with the Giants that they didn't get him? Because maybe they could have had him in their bullpen, but he really wanted to be a starter.
Yeah, there's no disappointment. I don't think there was ever a connection between Lincecum and the Giants. There was no reason for Lincecum to be interested in the Giants because they were looking at only a relief role, and Lincecum was hearing offers from other teams to start, especially the Angels. And that's the buzz I got when I covered the showcase on Willie Mays' birthday back on May 6th, a Friday, and there are a lot of Angels representatives. One was wearing a red Angels jacket. I mean, he wasn't hiding his
pretty obvious, right?
Or interest. And they seem to be the favorites all along. They just have a rotation here that is decimated by injuries, and the guys they do have, a couple of them, including Weaver, has just been struggling of late. But, you know,
he doesn't have any velocity anymore.
Well, no, he's coming off a pretty good performance, however. And I think that since Lincecum signed on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, they all had great starts by the Angels starters. So I don't know what that tells you, but maybe they're aware that Mr. Lincecum is coming, and that should be as early as June 12th. But, yeah, the reasons, you know, there are plenty. I won't go over all of them, but obviously we just mentioned the opportunity is golden in Anaheim. I'd look back to last year, and he had a 2.08 ERA through eight starts, right? I mean, best
great
ERA
start, yeah,
among the five starters about a year ago today. And then it's basically started to unravel, and by his last couple of starts in June, he couldn't go two innings. You know, the hip, the mechanics are back. The hip is fixed. There were hip issues last year. It messed with his long stride and step. You know, mechanically, it's a long, drawn-out deal, but basically he was pointing his toe one way, and if he pointed it the other way, he would have been back in stride, but he just couldn't close out the windup like he normally used to, and basically he had no command. He had little velocity. At the showcase, he reached 92 miles per hour, and you never saw 92 last year. You saw 86, 88, 89. So, you know, the mechanics, the opportunity, his arm, nothing wrong with his arm. He's, you know, he still has yet to ice his arm in the big leagues, believe it or not, unless he took a line drive off of it, which was the reason he went on the DL last year. So he's healthy. He's not over the hill. He's, you know, he's 31. A lot of guys are performing at a high level in their mid to late 30s still. Bartolo Colon, 40. So there are a lot of reasons. I mean, it's up to him now. I mean, he's been given the opportunity. He's got the contract, and now it's just up to him to succeed. And yeah, would it have been better if he was a Padre or Dodger? Probably, because he knows the NL West parks. He doesn't have to face a DH. He doesn't have to go into the AL East ballparks and learn about all of that. So it might have been better as a Padre, because certainly he performs well there, but he wouldn't be facing the Padres obviously. So anyway, there are a lot of reasons, and now it's up to him.
You know, it's too bad. I mean, who knows? Maybe he comes back to the Giants eventually, next year, year after. Mm-hmm. It's only a one-year deal.
Yeah.
But it's too bad that the Giants didn't get an opportunity to say goodbye. I mean, there wasn't going to be that with Pablo Sandoval because he definitely burned his bridges mm-hmm. in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But with other players, you know, that leave, and if you know they're leaving, it's great to have that chance. You know, David Ortiz, he's in his last year with the Red Sox. They're going to get to say goodbye, but nobody could do that with Lincecum.
Yeah, Mariano Rivera, remember he showed up in Oakland,
Jeter.
And they gave him a surfboard, some white wine. They gave him a check to his foundation, and then they beat him in 18 innings on a walk-off single by Nate Freiman. But that was a couple of years ago, and you know, A-Rod came into Oakland. They're not going to do anything for A-Rod, right? He spent those games on the DL. He says he's going to retire after next year. Who knows? It might have to be sooner. He's not hitting. And he's just coming back into the lineup this week. But yeah, with Lincecum, I asked that question many times. Will you honor him? Well, he's not an ex-Giant yet. There's still a chance. We want him back. He wants to come back.
Right.
Well, that's all fine and good. But I mean, he's 31. He's not retired. He's not close to moving on. The Angels will come to Oakland a couple times this year, but the Giants don't want any part of that, obviously. You know, he'll probably pitch next year. And you know, you honor somebody when you know it's the end.
Right.
But it would seem kind of unfair to say, well, let's have a Tim Lincecum day when you don't even know if he's going to pitch for you next year or not.
We'll have more with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle right after this. Hey, Giants fans, whether you're taking pictures of Little Leaguers or the pros, Tamron Lenses and Keeble & Shuckett Photography have the perfect lens for you. The award-winning Tamron 16-300mm all-in-one zoom is more versatile than your basic kit lens. With amazing Tamron quality and image stabilization, you'll never need to switch lenses again. Whether they are sliding into home or making a spectacular catch at the wall, your Tamron lens will catch them all. Tamron has lenses for all of your photographic needs, and you can get your Tamron lens at Keeble & Shuckett Photography in Palo Alto. Contact them at www.kspphoto.com. A little reminder, each week during the season, we'll be giving away a free t-shirt from thesportsvirus.com. All you have to do is ask a question for one of our guests, and if your question is chosen, you'll receive a free t-shirt from thesportsvirus.com. To send your questions in, email us at thesportsvirus@gmail.com or on Facebook, thesportsvirus.com page, and please like us while you're there. Now back to the conversation with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle. Since you mentioned A-Rod, he was always that player that, you know, some other players around the league didn't like, you know, and I think some pitchers would maybe, you know, go after him just because they didn't like him. And we saw something just recently between the Blue Jays and the Rangers where they had that big brawl, and it all stemmed from Jose Bautista hitting the home run in the playoffs and showboating, you know, flipping the bat and showboating a little bit. And, you know, that was a big home run. I mean, John Gibbons even said on this podcast that was how many years of frustration for
Joe
a country
Carter,
that they hadn't been in the playoffs in, you know, whatever it was, 20 some odd years, 23 years. So, but the, you know, the Rangers took exception to that and they got him back. They drilled him. And then he tried to get the Rangers back by sliding hard into second base. And you have the new rule mm-hmm. where you're not supposed to be able to take anybody out, but he didn't care. He just said, forget it. I'm going to slide right into Roofnet or Odor. And Odor just tried to deck him, and he punched him. So do you see more of this happening in baseball, because we still haven't really had a definition? There's the, you know, unwritten rules of baseball, but there isn't really a definition of whether or not you're supposed to be flipping a bat and whether or not you can even get somebody back at second base, because you're supposed to slide straight into the base nowadays.
Odor is kind of known as, I mean, he's asked Joe Panic. He's slid into him a couple of times very hard and maybe not so legally. And no, I don't think that's going to happen much. I mean, he's got a, what, 8-game suspension?
Yeah, 8 games, yeah.
When you get suspension, we were talking before we came on about that big 1984 brawl when the Padres, their World Series year, they went into Atlanta. There were just all kinds of ejections and suspensions. You would never get to that point because you would throw out that pitcher in the first inning. But now, you know, back then you were able just to stay in the game, and they just never, you know, threw you out until there was blood, basically. But now they'll throw you out if there's any doubt, and you know, there's more than doubt. Obviously, there was a punch in the cheek. So, you know, he got what he deserved. Bautista was a hard slide. If there wasn't a fight, he probably wouldn't have been suspended, but he would have been called out, I imagine. But regardless, I know. I think that they have the rules set in place, so that kind of stuff doesn't happen. It's rare that it would. And but still, the problem is, and you could talk to both Crawford and Panic, the Giants' two middle infielders, they hate the new rule on the neighborhood play, saying you have to have your foot on the base before you know, basically the neighborhood play is you have to be in the neighborhood with the ball. Maybe you don't have to have your foot on the bag when you have possession of the ball. That's to avoid injuries in their minds, right? It's been happening for decades, centuries, whatever. But now with all the replay and they're taking away the hard slide at second, they also said, well, the neighborhood play, you have to have your foot on the bag when you have possession of the ball. So that invites players to slide into you, maybe to hurt your calf, hurt your knee, hurt your ankle, whatever, because you can slide through the bag still as long as you don't let go of the bag. So you could slide through the bag. It's basically a takeout slide. If it's a bang bang in second base and Joe Panic gets a feed from Crawford and he's got to keep that foot on, well, somebody big, strong, and heavy is going to try to take him out, not going away from the line, the path of that you're running, but you could still take him out by going in hard, sliding past the bag, and then grabbing the bag as you pass it. So they both think that it's terrible to have that part of the rule still intact.
Do you think it's made it worse? And I mean, it's more dangerous now.
It is more dangerous. I think that's what they say. It's more dangerous to the middle infielders, you know, the very people you're trying to protect.
Here's the other part about it is that it's taken him a little while to get used to it. It seems like Crawford Panic seemed to be okay with it now as far as getting used to that. But we saw a play in Monday's game that, you know, it was subtle. I don't know that a lot of people noticed it. Mm-hmm. But Will Myers at first base, he had a ball hit to him. He's thinking double play, step on first, throw to second, get the tag. Well, he wasn't sure. He thought he had his foot right near the bag. And I think in the past, okay, that's just an out. Mm-hmm. Throw down to second. Well, he hesitated because he wanted to make sure he stamped first base because he was thinking about the rule. I think that's what was on his mind.
And I've seen Crawford just camp at second. You know, he said when this first came out, I asked him about it. He said, you know, I'm just going to have to make sure I'm there. So sometimes I see him just like 1,000, 2,000. Okay, now I can throw, right? And it's humorous sometimes how long he's actually staying there to avoid that call. And there was, remember the walk-off double play on the road trip, the same situation. You know, one manager's disputing the call at first, the other manager's disputing the call at second.
They're both
and,
out.
What drama, right?
Yeah. And then whoever the umpire was did it wrong. He was like, safe,
yeah,
out. Wait
exactly.
A minute. No, it was out,
yeah.
Out. And that's how the game ended. But, you know, that does lead us into replay. And what I think the solution is to improve it is that, you know, because we're talking about it taking too long. That's the problem. Everybody wants to get the calls right, but I don't think managers should be standing around saying, oh, should we look at that? Let's call on the phone. No, I think it should just be almost an immediate thing. Like, hey, we're going to look at that because it's blatant and you don't have a lot of time to tell the umpire. There should be kind of a limit there. And there should be a limit in New York as far as how long they can look at these replays. Maybe it's a minute. I mean, if it's blatant and you know, just do it. You don't have to examine it 800 times, freeze it, slow it down, you know, all this eight different angles, all that. And I don't know. What do you think? Is that a good solution or do you have another
idea? Well, I think they need to do something. Because the whole process, you know, they announced in the press box, well, that review took 2 minutes and 5 seconds. Well, no, it didn't, because you're not counting the time that Bochy waves to the umpire, turns around, looks at Wotus, who gets on the phone, talks to Sean Dunston in the clubhouse. Did you see that play? Well, I'm reviewing it. Hold on. Then Dunston gets back to Wotus. Wotus gets back to Bochy. Then Bochy says, okay, we'll review it. And okay, now you got to wait for the umpires to run in, put on their silly headphones. Okay, that's when it starts. That's when the 2 minutes and 5 second review
starts.
It's way
longer, yeah.
So what about the last 2 minutes and 5 seconds?
Doesn't count.
I mean, either yay or nay, and don't put on the headphones. Just give us a red light or a green light. You know, is it, is he out or safe? Yeah. Okay, we don't need this old silliness and the split screens. And let's get the reaction in 4 or 5 minutes when the guys in New York finally say, yeah, he's out or yeah, he's safe. But it just seems like, I mean, they did cut down because remember when they first started this, the Bochy and Bob Melvin, they had to go out there, tell the umpire, yeah, I'm challenging this, then had to go back. But now they can just, you know, say, hey, you know, everybody has Sounds a different way. Some people point here. Some people say, yeah, do it. But it's. I mean, for a commissioner who's coming in, Rob Manfred, saying we need to speed up the games, this is not the way to do it.
No, I don't think it's the way to do it either. Jason Stark from ESPN came on the podcast last week, and he was saying that it really is not increasing the time of games that much, but it just seems like an eternity because you're losing the action there. You're stopped and you're waiting. So I think something has to be done about it. And the other part about it is sometimes, you know, you think, okay, this is the be-all, end-all. We're going to get the call right. But there was a game against the Cubs. Trevor Brown made this incredible slide just eluding the tag. I forget who was trying to make the tag, but he was like Houdini. And the umpire at second base, he's right there, and he says safe. And you look at a couple of replays, and the tag was not made. He was safe. Yet they looked at it on replay, and I asked Ed Montague about this. Mm-hmm. He's one of the supervisors for Major League Baseball umpires, and he said they have more angles than you're going to see on television or at the stadium, and they said out. Yeah. Somehow they saw that, you know, there was concrete evidence, is what you need to overturn it. There was concrete evidence that he was tagged out. I was shocked.
Yeah, they need more transparency. When they see more than we see, we're going to second-guess them. So what we need is two things. We need the ultimate review that you saw, the replay that you saw, and you also need to tell everybody right away and flash it on the scoreboard exactly why you made that ruling.
Right.
I mean, don't let us guess what you're doing. And also tell us, you know, we know who the umpires are. Tell us who's in New York this week. You know, tell us, you know, there's supposed to be two crews, so that's eight people looking at all these replays. And, yes, they do have more replays than we see on the TV and on the scoreboard. They also have the overhead camera that looks down at everything. That's mostly to position players if they make a certain call where the runner's going to be, et cetera. But, yeah, they need a lot more explanation and transparency.
More with San Francisco Chronicle columnist John Shea in just a moment. Last year I was riding my bicycle in Marin when suddenly, flat tire. Thankfully, someone recommended I get my repair done at Breaking Away Bikes in Ross. While head mechanic and bike guru Rich quickly fixed my tire, I noticed the wide selection of bikes in the store. Breaking Away Bikes rents, demos, and sells all the bikes you could possibly need. Road bike? Check. Mountain bike? That was my choice, and I'm so glad I decided to buy it at Breaking Away Bikes, located in the heart of Ross at 7 Ross Common. Catch them on your way to ride Alpine, West Marin, and Petaluma, or call 415-461-2959 for Breaking Away Bikes. We're here at Keeble and Shuckett Photography, 290 California Avenue in Palo Alto, our on-site podcast. And what about the new rules that may go in place for a new strike zone? Major League Baseball is talking about that. Right below the batter's kneecaps is where it is now, but they're talking about to the top of the knees. And Matt Duffy, you might have heard on the podcast the other day, talking about how that could affect him. You know, he's not so much a high ball hitter, but he wasn't sure how it was going to affect him. And no more pitches for intentional walks is also being proposed. What do you think?
Well, yeah, uniformity is always good with the strike zone. Why you have strike zones for different hitters, it always seemed to bother me. Barry Bonds was, you know, about as big of the baseball itself, same with Ricky Henderson. But when you get any pitcher in there, it turns into the strikes. Everything's a strike sometimes, no matter what, just to get them out of there. It's like, let's just go to the rule. And if the rule says, around the armpit to below the knee, I mean, call it, because you don't see many strikes above the belt. And how many times have you heard a hitter say, you know, I was waiting for something up? You know, some people like to swing at that high pitch. Well, high meaning belt to belly button, which really isn't that high. But sometimes you see that call the ball. And that's a little bothersome. I mean, if they want to move it along, I don't think more walks is going to do it.
No, that's not going to help. Well, I guess they're trying to cut down on the strikeouts. Those low strikes are, you know, increasing the number of strikeouts? Because if you do look at strikeout averages, they're going up every year. I mean, this is the highest in a long time.
Well, is that
maybe ever,
is that because of this, or is that because nobody has a two-strike approach anymore?
Well, that's probably.
I mean, they go attacking 0-2 as if it was 3-1.
Right. Let me ask you this: is baseball trying too hard to make improvements? So, you know, we got pace of game, we've got replay, we're going to look at the strike zone, and even when
154 game schedule.
We have the schedule. What about Rob Manfred when he first became commissioner? He said, oh, I don't know about these defensive shifts.
Right.
Maybe we'll just make that illegal, which gladly he didn't say that, because you could play any defense you want.
Yeah.
You know, are they trying too hard? Maybe.
I don't know if they're trying too hard. They're trying to get it right, but what is right? I mean, that's the great debate. I want to hear what you said about replay. You were mentioning that you were all for it, and now maybe you're not.
I know. When I used to have a talk show on Sirius XM, I was a major proponent of replay. Let's get these calls right. But I don't like the way it's being executed.
Yeah.
It just it comes to a halt, a screeching halt, the game, and it just seems like an eternity. Let's just, you know, move it along.
How do you want it done?
Like I was saying, I think the umpire says to the manager, okay, do you want to do this or not? And if they're going to look at it, 60 seconds, you get 1 minute. And hopefully they're already looking at it back in New York. And if they can't determine it in 1 minute, just move on.
So you want replay to be initiated by a manager who doesn't have access to replay?
Yeah. Just he knows, he looks at it on the field.
That,
says, you
I
know
used
what?
To believe that, but then they say, well, that. I mean, the naked eye can't see everything.
Well, ask the player. Ask Trevor Brown. Did he tag you? No, I didn't feel anything.
Well, then it's like the NBA. They never commit a foul either.
Exactly.
Right?
As we finish up here at Keeble and Shuckett Photography, there's a story out about Tony Gwynn's family filing a lawsuit. Of course, Tony Gwynn passed away. And I know you were close to him because you went to school together at San Diego State. And, you know, the chewing tobacco was – something that you know, really affected his life, and then it took him from us, basically. So what do you think about this lawsuit and what might happen? Maybe people will learn from it?
Yeah, Tony died 2 years ago at age 54 of cancer. He always thought I got cancer because, you know, I chewed. It was right on the side of the cheek that he did chew. And, you know, the lawsuit, they're basically suing the tobacco industry because they claim that he died and was a target at age 17 when he went to San Diego State, and I was there with him. I was a schoolmate of his because he was a target for four reasons. He was young, he was an athlete, he was in college, and he was African American. And therefore, the tobacco companies targeted him as their promotion to other kids that age, you know, to use Skoll Copenhagen. And I remember Skoll and Copenhagen came on campus, and they just had all kinds of tins they just gave out for free trying to get kids addicted. You look at it now, it's pretty pathetic.
Yeah.
But at the time, you say, wow, free T-shirts, free dip. And, you know, fortunately, I tried it and didn't like it, but a lot of guys tried it, including Tony. I remember his whole baseball team at San Diego State dipped. People in the press box dipped. It was just the culture. And you get hooked, and then the tobacco companies got you. But it seems like a long shot for the family to win this thing. I mean, as we all know, there's all kinds of you know, money for you know, attorneys representing tobacco companies. So what it might do is bring awareness, and perhaps they won't benefit financially, but more awareness would be brought to this issue. You know, now you look at all these college campuses, they all have, you know, tobacco-free guidelines, and even in the major league, San Francisco here, it's against the law to chew tobacco at the ballpark.
Right.
Do I see it in the clubhouse? Of course I do.
Right.
Do I see it on the field? Yeah. But you don't see the tin in the back pocket anymore. You don't see it as flagrant. Barry Bonds hit his record-breaking home run beating Aaron with a tin in the back pocket. You see it in all the pictures, and you just don't see that anymore.
Which helps, yeah. So hopefully There's definitely more awareness, as you said. Well, I want to thank everybody here at Keeble and Shuka Photography in Palo Alto for hosting us. Remember, again, next week we've got Angel Pagan on the podcast, as well as Chris Shaw, the Giants prospect, and Paul Byrd, former Major League pitcher, now working on the Braves broadcast. John, thanks so much.
I enjoyed it. Let's do it again.
That's John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle. I want to thank him and everybody from Keeble and Shuka Photography for helping us out with our on-site podcast and hosting us this week. Coming up on Monday, we will preview the Giants-Braves series in Atlanta with former Major League pitcher Paul Byrd, who is now an analyst and sideline reporter on Fox, covering the Braves. For now, I'm Joe Castellano. Thanks for listening to Inside China Basin on thesportsvirus.com.